On today's episode of On the Line, we have Chef Roy Choi,
a dear friend, an amazing chef and a culinary trendsetter.
LA royalty.
A man who has helped to put food trucks on the road, and now he's bringing his tacos to the street. He is going to meet the people face to face, and he's going to tell us, well, how he's done it, where he's going, and where to find his delicious tacos.
Growing up as a Korean immigrant, going to the Culinary Institute of America, to starting the chef-driven food truck craze, and then, of course, being in Hollywood and starring in the movie Chef.
Welcome, Chef Roy Choi.
On the Line.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, no more laughing.
No. Wait, why?
Let's be serious.
Okay.
Why? Is this a
good
serious
being
podcast?
Serious. No, absolutely not.
No, yeah, it's
the
very
intro.
Serious.
But Dan's going to do the...
Yeah, his... no, I wrote a little thing because I wanted to introduce folks that don't know who you are.
Oh, yeah.
I even wrote that. I said, for those of you who don't know who Roy
y'all
is.
Y'all don't know who I am?
I can't believe there's anybody in
this
universe.
He's ain't got no love.
The next line says, it's time to crawl out from under whatever rock you've been hiding under.
That's okay. Perfect.
If you don't know. Yeah. So Roy's a huge and meaningful impact on the dining scene here in Los Angeles and the culinary industry as a whole, right? Agreed? First and foremost, Roy's a chef's chef, a guy you can find cooking alongside his team. He may hang out with the celebrity set. But don't let that fool you. The man can throw down with the pots and pans. And secondly, Roy is an author, a TV personality, an entrepreneur. But most importantly, he's an extraordinarily loyal friend and father, a husband, and a business partner. All the people that he's ever known or worked with, he still knows and works with. It's like very unique in your world.
Absolutely.
And he's an unwavering community activist, a dedicated philanthropist, and someone who puts their money where their mouth is, and he lives the life that they preach, which is special as well. So as a chef, Roy took a huge career risk 15 years ago. 15 years ago?
This is the 16th year. Yeah.
16 years ago. He had worked his way up in the hotel industry. Holding a leadership role at a big box hotel can be a very rewarding job. Good stable hours, good stable pay. It can be fulfilling leading a large team and feeding a lot of people every single day. And with plenty of long-term upside, but Roy had put his time in and he'd grown through the ranks and finally was in a position to be, you were in a position to be in the leadership role of one of those big box hotels and do that, but he was not fulfilled with the work and he decided to give it up and start, well, lower than the bottom rung. He started outside of the kitchen in a, and gave up his restaurant in exchange for a food truck, which is like now cool thing to do.
Right.
When
you right. At the time, no one.
At the time, no one
was doing that.
So at the time, the food trucks were served a completely utilitarian purpose. Construction workers and quick and cheap and easy meals for people on the go. There were a few fancy food trucks up in the Pacific Northwest, but nothing that would give a family man the confidence to gamble his hotel salary on opening one. And that said, Roy is a gambler.
Woohoo!
Which is another piece of the puzzle. The gamble paid off. And there's a ton of info about Kogi and the impact of its success, and it's still going, and you can go get the delicious tacos. And I learned about perilla leaves there, which was a thing, and they're delicious. But it took off. And you can look it up. I'm not going to go on.
Is this the podcast that tells people to Google it? Just Google it.
But time has proven that this success was not a gimmick. So this is a piece of the puzzle that I think is important about Roy, is that there's something very special about him. And it's kept Kogi alive and running, along with the amazing team that you surround yourself with. And the special thing that has continued to propel your success across all of your endeavors. And from nearly 30, I've known you for like almost 30 years.
So,
27 years. So for 27 years of observation, what I can say is that the special and unique thing is that you are authentically yourself, right? Which means that you approach your work true to yourself, and that you put it out there for people to judge and accept as it is. So you're like, this is something I like. This is who I am. And go fuck yourself. We came up in an era where to be a respected restaurant chef, you had to make fancy food for rich people. But that's changed. And that has changed in large part because of people like you who have had the audacity to redefine the meaning of hospitality. which is a real thing you did, right? Mm-hmm. So thank you for helping us all feel confident following our personal dream and helping to build a world where our dream can come true, even if our dream isn't cooking for fancy people.
Thank you.
Roy Choi, everybody.
Thank you.
Round of applause.
That's it.
That's the podcast.
What else do you all want me to say?
Thank you for being on the podcast. Yeah, we'll see you later.
Wait, but I can't help but notice how much you guys have in common, first of all.
We're both dressed in black.
Yes. But, you know, Danny Boy's Pizza.
Yeah.
The Kogi truck, Tacos Por Vida. Like, this is all, like you said, the everyman food. Right. Yeah. We all started out. We were just talking about the Culinary Institute of America. We're all graduates. Mm-hmm. We all started out in a white toque with a white coat and a neckerchief. And that was our path. Right. Mm-hmm. But then now what you've done, you've laid a path for other people to break that mold and do something completely different. And this is the kind of food you want to cook. You talk so much about making pizza and the price of food and feeding somebody, like that's super important right now. And I think so much has changed since we started. All of us started. We were just talking about being up in Poughkeepsie at Hyde Park. And now we're talking about, you know, food truck. You're being a founder of the food truck. You're cooking pizza every day. You know, the chef life is completely different. Completely different. But I think after a while, you had to break that mold and just do something that you loved. You know, cook what you love, because there was no way you would survive without it, I think. You know, I don't think you could be as sustainable as you have been over all these years if you were trapped and pigeonholed into that kitchen that way.
Yeah, you know, it's very much like it reflects society a lot, too, especially you see it in entertainment, podcasting, content creation. You know, the world in the food world, very much like entertainment, was controlled by a handful of people, you know, and restaurants were controlled by investors. Entertainment was controlled by executives. But now, since things have been democratized through technology, we all have a voice and we all have opinions and our ability to put ourselves out there. And, you know, before there was it was a linear ascension to what you had to do. You had to go through these gateways. But now you ain't got to kiss no fucking rings no more. That's, you know, you can just do whatever you want to do. So that's an amazing thing. And food is food, you know. There are still some, you know, organizations that are still trapped in the past and are clinging on with their fingertips, you know, like Michelin and San Pellegrino, World's 50. Fuck those, both of them, you know, because they don't recognize, you know, they don't recognize, you know, what is important for the people. It's still trapped in its own cloak, in its own, you know, veil. But
I think you've been embracing technology for so long. Yeah. Like, I remember in 2009, you know, when I first met you, you could only find the Kogi truck if you're on Twitter.
Yeah,
that was the only way. And, you know, to think, I honestly think about you as like the founder of that, you know, of that, of the food truck and of reaching people through social media to get them to eat your food.
The only thing I want to say is thank you for that. The only thing I want to say is we're not the founders of the food truck, because there is a whole history before us.
Right.
You know, I look at us as like the children of our ancestors, you know, and our parents. And, you know, immigrant food has existed in this country since immigration. So it all exists out there on the streets. It just wasn't written about in mainstream American media, or it wasn't acknowledged or honored. What we were able to do, again, if you look at it through the metaphor of the children, we were able to take our non-English speaking parents, the culture and the food that we grew up around, we were able to translate that to a larger American audience. Mm-hmm. And the way we were able to do that was through technology. And so through social media, really what we did was we just took everything that was already existing out there on the streets and we just kind of repackaged it and you know, put a different voice behind it. And everything changed, you know. Who could have ever predicted it? Because that wasn't our plan when we started. Our plan was just to make $800 a night. That was that was our plan. We were parking in front of the clubs at 2 a.m. And our like window of opportunity was from 2 to 4 a.m. if we could make $800, because we weren't selling anything before that. We were waiting for the clubs to get out.
Yeah, 2 hours.
And that was it. We were just trying to make $800, get to the next day, use $400 to buy produce, pay our team, have maybe $100 left, you know, and then just get to the next day. But, you know, I don't know, something crazy happened and things started to change and then it became really deep, you mm-hmm. know, and everything.
I don't think it was, I think from the beginning it was special though. It was never like...
It was special, yeah. But it tasted special, and that's what possessed us. And that's no, what made
I
don't. Us go
I
out
think you tapped into the idea that mm-hmm. that food was like cooks were servants. You went through the back door. You used the back door entrance. You used the employee bathroom in the changing room, and then you dressed up in your fancy white white clothing, and you were behind the kitchen, and maybe they got a little glimpse of you, and you were like, "No, we are people." This is not how people eat or want to eat. This is not the food was shifting out of the home and onto the street where people could commune.
I mean, I agree with that, and we knew something was special, but we couldn't put the pieces together in the first few months, right? Because everything was happening in real time. Mm. But what did happen is those feelings were deep inside, but we didn't know that this was going to be the avenue to be able to create a new philosophy of life. But what happened was. When it started to get deep, it just it went from trying to make $800 a night and trying to feed everyone on the streets to like it changing the language and the perception around how people view the food that we cook. Mm-hmm. Because things were being called roach coaches, trucks were being called dirty. You would get sick off of all fairness, these old horrible jokes.
I grew up in
jokes.
New York City where, you know, I've seen the halal roaches come trucks. Out of those coaches.
You see roaches?
They're delicious, but I've seen a lot
of roaches come out of restaurants, too.
Yes, you know? They do.
They come out of restaurants, too. You
and
know?
They live in there. They don't always come out.
I'm a big fan of a street dog.
But that's cool what you said, because I remember, because Dee and I go way back to when he was really young. We used to work at La Bernardin, and we used to work in this huge, La Bernardin is on the bottom floor of this huge office building. And on 51st Street, we used to have to go in the back down the stairs,
the labyrinth,
and then we'd all get undressed and everyone
in the locker
would have,
room together.
Yeah, and then there was like a little window where people could see the natives in the kitchen. Yeah.
Yes,
you know, as they were cooking for them. But the I feel like. I don't know what I was going to say. Move on. Mm-hmm. You continue. So.
No. Just those are fun days, man, when we used to go down there. And we used to eat down there and we all get changed together. It was like we were like a basketball team.
It was. Like, I mean, I don't think a lot of people really think about the locker room vibe of a restaurant. But I worked at Vong in 1991.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I was changing in the locker room with everybody else.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. I think that all the...
It's all dudes.
The dudes, but all the females changed with us, too.
We were all in the same
room. Yeah, but it wasn't
like I was in my skivvies. I mean, I wore a t-shirt and underwear, you know.
Yeah, I mean, but
all the other cooks were in the leopard stripe.
I wore a banana silk. Come on. What's his name?
All
did
the Latin
wear a,
guys.
A silk.
Juan and
everyone's a thing. It's very comfortable.
Yeah, but there was a dirty locker room vibe. And then if you were eating family meal, you turned over a milk crate and you're sitting in the dry storage or you're sitting next to the garbage.
It was such
a
civilization down there because then all the captains would be counting their money.
Yes.
You know, in front of all the cooks who were barely surviving.
Oh, my God. I had a rule. When I worked at Verbena, I had a rule because I used to work doubles on Sundays. Uh-huh. And all of our guys would work Saturday night and we'd all work doubles into Sunday. And the servers would come in between brunch and dinner and count their cash
in the
kitchen. And I was like, you guys cannot.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that.
You're not allowed to do that. Like, I just was like, I'm sorry. I was friendly with everybody, but I was like, you can't. Go do it
somewhere
else.
We're losing cooks fast enough. Yeah. The last thing you need to do is
I used to love Verbena.
Wasn't that a great restaurant?
That was a great restaurant.
It's a gem. Wow. And, you know, we tried to keep a really good culture there. And we wanted to make it feel like a family. But you don't come in and count your money in front of people who have worked 18 hours in a row and have no money. You know, it's
what were we making in New York as cooks back then? We were making $400 a week.
I made $525 an hour.
$500 a week.
Up to six.
Minimum wage.
$525 an hour was my beginning. So it must have been close to
like a dollar more than minimum wage.
You probably made a lot more than you negotiated your.
I didn't negotiate nothing, man.
But when you talk about family and you talk about Kogi, I think that your customers, your guests, your clients are as much of the family as the people who cook with you.
Yeah.
I really feel that. Like the people who are your patrons, they are, I don't know, I think they feel a real connection to you. And I feel like just even looking at your social media, like taking a picture every time of the first people online, like there's a connection.
It happened organically. We're kind of like a jam band. Yeah. You know, we're like Fish exactly. or Widespread.
You have such a loyal following.
Yeah, we're like Widespread Panic. Like we just like, there's something about like, and I see like older rock bands like Alice Cooper and stuff like that, that the fans have stayed with them since the 70s and you see them grow with them the whole time. I don't know, something like that. Like we just started this taco pop-up, Tacos Por Vida, and the same people that were waiting in line in Kogi 15 years ago are coming out with mixed with new people, but are coming out again. So it's like really great to see those faces.
Wow. A very generous taco, a very delicious and generous
thank you,
taco.
Thank you.
But there's also a culture and a vibe around it. 100%.
Yo, I think that
we're also expressing ourselves in real time. Yes. I think that's what you were touching on in your soliloquy of my life. Is that we're very honest and transparent with our audience and ourselves. And so like we're not only is that honesty in the food, but we're also like Tacos Por Vida, we did the whole soft opening in real time with the public. So it was almost like we were documenting and going through all our mistakes, you know, out in the open with everyone. And that, you know, that's scary. And that's like practicing, you know, a Broadway show and showing the rehearsals to the audience. You know, it's
so vulnerable.
Yeah. But the audience is, it's an audience participation show. On the Line podcast is brought to you by Danny Boy's Famous Original Pizza. From downtown Los Angeles and Westwood, Los Angeles, Danny Boy's Pizza started with a singular goal of producing the best slice of pizza that we could possibly create. We make New York-style pizza with the finest ingredients, built by a team of fun-loving, like-minded, culinary-driven individuals, producing slices of pizza that are not going to empty your wallet, but they will fill your belly. Come down to Danny Boy's and say hi. I am on the line, cooking them up for you, as well as on the line with Amanda Freitag, here in the studio, for you.
That's
kind of the whole point.
It's almost like a... like the Groundlings Theater or something. It's like sketch comedy.
And you've like taken yourself off of the pedestal and said, hey, we're part of the people. Mm-hmm. We're peers and we're cooking for you, mm-hmm. but you're our guests, which means that we can kick you out if you're rude as well. Like we're part of this as a team together, which is a big difference between being like, I'm making fancy food, mm-hmm. which was the only example that we kind of had. Like you come up, you got this example of, you know, that white toque chef, and that's what you're aspiring to be. And then at some point you're like, I don't know, is this who I really am? Mm-hmm. And now thankfully to you and folks, you know, that have taken kind of that risk, you're like, oh, there's an option for me to go in either direction. But that doesn't necessarily mean you can't, you got to put in the work, right? You still got to put up, you still get judged by your food. And if it doesn't taste good, people aren't going to pay
you. Well, Kogi happened after, you know, 15, 20 years of cooking. So then... Right. You know, when you put in the work and then you go out and express yourself honestly, you have the foundation to be able to do that, right? Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I see a lot of, especially now, because the downside of this democratization of expression is that a lot of people get into it too early.
I'm glad you're talking about that.
So what happens is because they have the opportunity, they can get famous or go viral overnight. Which is cool, man. Everyone should do shoot whatever they want to do. Shoot your shot, you know. Yeah. But what happens is there's no foundation for them to work off of. So once they get past a certain point, they start repeating the same thing, like the same sandwich or the same ASMR or all those things.
Which, you're in Japan, is great because you just
make the same
sandwich forever.
Culturally, you just gotta be in the right country.
Yeah. But you need to have a whole base to pull from. Yeah. You know, it's like your upbringing. Obviously, your family had restaurants and different businesses. Yeah. You love the fusion of Mexican and Korean. You know, but of course, you worked in French and you know global cuisine. Like, you have something to pull from to get to those flavors. You know, and I think it's really just talking about CIA again, being there, like seeing these kids that are wide-eyed and hungry and wanting to know what they can do in the industry. And they all ask me, like, what do we do? What do we do? I'm like, work in a restaurant. Yeah. Work in a restaurant.
Learn
I don't
how
care
to cook.
What you're going to do. If you're going to be a food stylist, you're going to be a director of photography. I don't care. Work in a restaurant.
Well, back in our when we were coming up, I mean, I think the golden rule was 7 years. You work 7 years in a restaurant as a cook. Every year, a year and a half, 2 years,
you move kitchens. Are there Beethovens of food? Are there kids that just... I wonder
there
about
are,
this. Like, are there
I'm
people
sure.
that are really like... have a perfect that, pitch and can cook right off the
right
I don't
off
know.
The bat. Yeah. That I've seen it, you know, definitely on, you know, TikTok and YouTube.
Other than me, obviously.
Yeah. TikTok and YouTube. I mean, you started young too, so there are a lot of young.
But I didn't know how to cook. I think it's a, definitely creators. A craft. You gotta like learn how to.
Well, they're able to absorb on their own in their room through YouTube now. So they're able to practice, absorb, see. You know, which is great. And then they're when they put out their first video or when they first start, there's already a well of knowledge that they've absorbed through their eyes and through their body. So maybe, I don't know.
It's an interesting way to go about it because obviously we just cooked food and served it to people and that was it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, sometimes I think this generation, that young generation has it so much easier, but it's actually harder.
Yeah.
You have to know how to cook food. You have to know how to be comfortable in your skin and confident about it. And then it's all visual. It's all out there. It has to look good. You have to look good. You have to talk about it. You have to know how to put this together. So I think it's really almost more difficult.
And you can get better. You know, I mean, you could start off, there probably are Beethovens that start off great, like whether it's jujitsu or food or whatever.
Right.
Like someone can come out of the scene and be like extremely talented.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take away from the fact, like someone maybe could come out and be really good like at wrestling or jujitsu against you. But that doesn't mean that they can't learn more as they go into it, you know?
Right.
So you have like a natural proclivity. Yeah. You're naturally predisposed to being good at it. And then the work you put in is just going to.
But the problem is sometimes they don't put in the work after they get famous. That's the only thing. That's the only criticism I have is that sometimes the learning can stop.
What do you think about the famous
versus the like your choice? Because you get to have the choice of like, do I want to be a celebrity person or do I want to be a cook person? And you kind of spend your time, it feels like from the outside, cooking in the kitchen to cook for the people. Are you like, you know, when you have an opportunity to make money not working in a blue collar job, it's got to be very attractive.
Well, you know, I've done TV and I've written books and done other things, but My main line is still cooking. It's still food, you know. It may not necessarily be opening the biggest or the most popular restaurants in town or whatever the case may be, or being like the one that's getting all the awards, but I'm always out there trying to cook, you know, for the people and for the fans, you know, and trying to open new things.
Well,
you
I think
know,
that
a
goes
lot of
back
it is
to
just
the learning,
art,
right?
Yeah,
like, don't
just
you want to just
form,
keep learning?
Know?
Like, I think our generation, and I know I can speak for myself, like, I just want to keep learning. Like, that's why I love to travel so much, right? That's why we go to different restaurants and different cultures so we can keep learning. I've taught myself all this technology because I want to know. I don't want to be that person who's like, I don't know how to do it. Yeah, I know how to do it. You know, I don't want to sit back and say, okay, I'm done. You know, like,
and you guys have the challenge of not just being chefs on TV, but being actual TV personalities, which is a growth thing too, right?
It's a growth thing
being
as well.
Chopped and then like looking at yourself over time, over seasons, and really working on your camera, you know,
just even vocabulary, exactly.
Everything, you know.
Describing food, you have to be articulate. Mm-hmm. You have to take a bite of something. And really, I think about what it would sound like to somebody and would it really resonate? Would it really tell them what it tasted like? But, you know, maybe it's why I'm not so hugely popular in the TV world is like, I'm not an actress. I've never been that. I'm just a chef and I'm passionate about food.
Oh,
and
man,
so
you're the one. Like, I don't watch Chopped unless you're a judge.
Thank you.
Shit.
But
fuck
like,
all the other judges. You're the one.
It's funny because I still want the chef who's there competing to learn something.
Yeah.
Like that's so when I give a judgment, I want them to walk away learning something because I know when I compete, which I can't believe I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
I still compete.
I don't know how y'all compete.
It's really hard
compete.
For the
why
heart.
Aren't you on those shows?
I can't compete. I don't cook
it's
quickly.
Really stressful.
I don't like to cook quickly.
I learn something about myself every time I do it. Every time.
Yeah.
So I always want to say no, but when I say yes, as much as I hate it and the adrenaline makes me feel like I'm going to die, I learn something every single time.
That's cool. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I don't want to beat anybody. And then the other thing is I don't like to lose. So I'm trapped between both. So one, I don't like, I'm there's like this like really namaste side to me where I like cooking is about like losing sharing. Sucks. I don't want to be.
I get it.
And if I don't lose, I got knives. I'm like, I want to kill them.
Yes, it really, honestly, it really sucks. I lose all the time. I'm like the Susan Lucci of cooking competition, if anybody knows who she is.
I don't know who that is. Who's that?
Susan Lucci was a soap opera actress who was nominated for daytime Emmys for like 20 years in a row and never won. Ever, not one. I think eventually she won one. Anyway, but I think what's great for me, and I know this about you, is like any kind of media presence that propels you gives you the platform to help people to do what you really want to do, right? Like, so you're obviously a community activist. You want to help. You want to give back. You've done so many things that then bring you joy, right? There's only so much joy you can get from feeding people, and that I think is our ultimate joy, and we share that. But then when you're able to do something where you can help people, I think is the ultimate. I'm for me personally. And you do it in so many different ways with people who, like kids who are struggling, communities who are struggling, people who need jobs and training. I mean, you've been doing that for a really long time, and you still are.
Yeah, it's a part of everything that I am. You know, it's the way I grew up. It's the communities I come from. It's the people I still interact with that are my friends and family, you know. And so the way I look at it is I was lucky enough to be able to do whatever I do. But I remember how it was being a kid like that, you know. So, you know, you got to be there for them. It's Did not you? Just a phrase of giving back. You got to like, you got to interweave it. And it doesn't mean that you have to go back to community that you're not connected with. You could go back to whatever past you had, but you have to interweave it with who you are and just make it a part. I try to make it a part of a balance of every decision that we make. So if we make like a business decision, there has to be something community driven that balances that as well.
That's, you know? That's the way to do it. I mean, did your parents teach you that part? I mean, when I grew up, both my parents worked, grew up in a suburb. That we didn't do a lot of charity stuff. We didn't do a lot of philanthropy. It wasn't a part of our upbringing. I really got that through the chef community, honestly.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey, in the suburbs.
I think charity is like a Christian thing.
Well, we also, we didn't have a lot of religion in our life, and we didn't have a lot of money. So my parents, you know, you keep your money, you bank your money. There's a lot of work ethic. You work for your money. If you want something, you work for it and you pay for it.
Everyone for themselves. You just do what you do.
And that was it. So I honestly learned about giving back through the chef community, because then it would be, oh, my chef's going to do this benefit for City Harvest, and I'm going to go sit behind the table and serve 1,000 people. Like, that's when I learned about it, really.
We were never really on the philanthropy side because we didn't have money either. But the thing is that it was always community driven, because as immigrants in this country, like sometimes all you got is each other, you know, or as minorities in this country, you know, you have a lot of people who aren't minorities in this country don't understand what it's like growing up as a minority in this country, because you have to live double lives. Yep. You know, you have the life that you are and how you look and your family and where you're from. But then you have to go out into the regular world and get a job or go to school and interact with everyone else. So, you know, those can be manifested in different ways, whether it was back in the day in your lunchbox, or it could be not bringing anyone to your home, or the way, or being ridiculed or being yelled at or having racist things thrown at you out in public. You have to absorb all that shit. And so then what happens is you band together. You band together within your own communities, and then you spend time together. You share together.
That's a safe zone.
Yeah, safe zone. But you also share. So that part of giving is that we're not in this alone.
Right.
And whatever you have, I can break off a piece for you and you, and then we go through it together. You know, usually those happen like on the weekends, or you bring food over for everyone. And then you go back out there and you deal with all the bullshit in the world again.
I love that description of that, because I think that anybody who's never experienced that doesn't understand.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, you know, immigrants want to stay together in their communities. It's safe and they share something, and it's a different vibe, you know, but those are very generous communities that share food with other people that don't know. And like, this is how we learn about you. This is how we learn about Roy. This is how we learn about Dan. When you cook for us, you know, if that's how we learn about each other, like that's, to me, is a great connection of food.
Yeah.
But that's gotta be scary, because people are not always open to it.
Yeah, and you know, food has definitely been a huge part, especially in the last 10, 20 years of building bridges, you mm-hmm. know, like, because, you know, the world was so fucked up in the 80s and 70s and 60s and 50s, you know, going yeah. back, you know, like, you know, the root and the basis of this country is built off of horrible actions and racism and genocide, you know, so for now, things to be changing and being, for someone to be able to see someone beyond the color of their skin through their food and then be interested in that food and then make it a part of their lives is, you know, it's a big step. It's a baby step, but it's a big step towards changing things.
Right. I get so frustrated sometimes that our industry is something that everybody wants to be a part of, right?
Yeah.
Every celebrity wants to have a cooking show, you know, every model wants to have a cookbook. But at the same time, it's kind of good. It's kind of good because if you do it right, like you, you can connect people that way and you can bring people together that way. And, you know, I talk about the Food Network stuff, but you've had a huge impact through, you know, the chef movie, the chef show. How did you, I'm just going to ask personally, how did you meet Jon Favreau? How did you meet him?
There was like a matchmaking situation. So he was in pre-production for his movie. Uh-huh. And so at the final stages of like...
For Chef, the
movie. They had already written the script. They're in pre-production. They're figuring out all the logistics and details. And the last piece of it was that he had to actually learn how to cook. So they were looking for a teacher or a chef. And somehow my name came up. And it was supposed to be just a job. I always say, like, if he was doing a boxing movie or a wrestling movie.
He would train.
Like, you're the coach or whatever.
I'm the coach. I go in for 3 weeks. I teach him different movements, and I'm gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But we fell in love on the first day.
Oh, man. My God.
Just
I
like
love
me
it.
And you. Just like like D and me, you know. Like, we...
For anybody who's listening who's never seen it, there's an amazing movie. I've probably seen it about 10 times. It's called Chef with Jon Favreau and... Sofia Vergara is in that movie, right?
Sofia Vergara, Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson.
Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, such a good movie.
John Leguizamo.
Oh, I love him.
Robert Downey Jr.
I mean, this is kind of a pivot, right? Like a change that happened. You did the movie with John. You guys became really close, obviously.
Yeah, from day one. We were the first day we met, I had him meet me at one of my spots, and then I figured it would be great to take him around on my routes. So at that time I had a few different restaurants and the trucks out there, and my normal day would be going around and checking on all the spots, you know, like we do. Sure. If you have multiple restaurants, you spend an hour in each spot. So I figured 6 hours, jump in the car, come with me on a normal route. And we just bonded, man. We were just like two lost friends. And then from that point, it just became more than a job.
Right.
You
were really involved in the making of the movie.
Ended up hanging out.
Right.
And even when I wasn't supposed to be there, I was there. Yeah. You know, and so.
And that was the very first time that you were on a movie set, like full Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
You had done some TV stuff. Some Food Network stuff.
No, I didn't have my own show at that time, but I had been a guest on Anthony Bourdain's show by that time.
That's right.
And then I had done like early Food Network stuff where they, because when Kogi was like popping off.
Yeah, we did a challenge at your truck.
Yeah,
there
would be things like the Unique Eat Show or those type of things where they would come in and do that type of stuff.
I've got a video of you on Chilling and Grilling with Bobby Flay.
I was never on that show.
Yeah, you were at the embassy. Outside. I found it in my house. I've got it on a CD in my house. I got to.
I love
it
that
to
reaction.
Amazing.
I was never on that show.
Wasn't the Chill and Grill. It was he was out there for the celebrity golf championship. And
he's like 11 years old. Yeah. I'm like 10. I'm like 5. You know.
Yeah, and then it was early. This was like 2001.
Oh
yeah.
Wow!
Bobby and Lawrence came out for the for the golf tournament and. I think he had just come out with his first line of sauces and spices at that time. And then he was promoting those. So somehow the tournament used our hotel as his home base. And they were filming something about it there. And I was nobody. I was just like doing all the mise en place and setting it up and then cooking with him. But it was cool.
I mean, Food Network had only started in like 98, I think. So that was early on.
It was early days. Yeah.
Actually, a friend of mine is the creator and producer of Unique Eats, Irene Wong. I don't know if you remember.
I remember Irene. Shout out Irene. Hey,
yeah.
Irene.
Hi, Irene.
Terribly talented.
We miss you. Yes.
And extremely meticulous.
Is she still on TV?
She's doing some stuff, but nothing of her own anymore.
That was great. I mean,
she did a great job.
Irene's show was great.
They would do.
She was like, she's an artist.
Close-ups over and over and over of each step of the dish. I really respected it.
That was the longest day of filming of my life.
Remember that?
With her. Yeah.
Yes. She's meticulous about
and it also
food.
Was very impactful for the business.
Meticulous, but not like annoying.
No, because she respects the chefs.
Yeah, it was like one
and
of those.
And the artistry of it.
You never rolled your eyes. You were like, yo, yeah, cool. Yes, yes.
She makes everything you're doing look beautiful.
Yeah, that was a great show.
It was a great show. So anyway, so you started a little bit of the television stuff. Then boom, you're like Hollywood movie set.
Hollywood movie set, yeah. And then indie movie set with John and all of these like legendary actors and cinematographers and producers. And everyone just, and that's where food becomes a bridge again, you know, like, it, you know, because a lot of times in Hollywood or any industry, people are just trying to get a, you know, like, network or get ahead or anything. But they knew that everyone was here for the art of the movie. So it was a very equal environment. So, like, they let me get as far as I need. As I could anywhere I needed to go, you know what I mean? And so
you got the all access pass.
I got the all access pass and I contributed and
did you get the bug for it? Like, did you want to do it again? I mean, it sounded like that was also a really beautiful bubble of people who cared and a wonderful experience. I'm sure not every movie set is like that, but
well, it definitely, I got the bug. It opened up from that point. Then things happened. Cause up until then, even though I had been a guest on certain shows, I was aware of it, one, growing up here in L.A. and Hollywood. I had seen it my whole life. A lot of friends, mothers, and parents worked at places like Paramount.
Sure. Or,
you know,
it's a big industry.
Different studios. And, it's our job, you know, like people's jobs out here, whether they were grips or sound or, you know, camera or whatever. So
crafty.
I had already said crafty. I had already seen it. But also in the first... So we started filming that in 2013. Kogi started OA. So for the first 5 years at Kogi, we were really popular as a catering truck in Hollywood for sets, whether they were lunch or wraps or anything, wrap parties. And so I had been around it. But after the movie, I got a bug. And it's weird how when sometimes something affects you like that, if you manifest it, life follows that way. After that, I had gotten a couple offers to do shows. And then I started, then I came out with our book, L.A. Sun. And after that, I had been approached for a lot of, pitching a lot of scripted versions of that. So of the story. So then all of a sudden, I'm all up in the mix.
And
still never got, I got non-scripted shows to the screen, but I never got a scripted show.
Do you still want to do it?
I'm still trying, man. Hollywood's hard as fuck.
Hollywood takes forever.
You know, what I learned in Hollywood is, because in our industry, in food, if you say there's a table for two and I'm cooking for you, like you're in, right? Like you're in. But in Hollywood, when they buy something, it's only the first stage. And that shit threw me for a loop.
Yeah.
Because as cooks, we just like honesty and we like straightforwardness. But I know the industries are different, but it messes with your mind.
Five shows and nothing ever sees the air.
So the idea of the word, you sell something, like in my mind as a cook, is like we made an agreement.
It's you tell all your friends, I'm so excited about this thing.
You got a table.
And by the way, this is my livelihood, so
Like
I'm
and if you work
it.
Hard, you'll get the reward. But it's not like that in Hollywood.
No, because then I learned the difference between selling something and greenlighting something. And that was the whole thing I learned in
Hollywood. Let me ask you.
It's a big difference.
Do you think that the same way that the food truck kind of brings the food out of the restaurant and onto the street, is that, you know, where social media is taking the entertainment industry, where you see, like, you know, do people go still to the Food Network to get their food information, or are people looking on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok? And is that like a viable, realistic?
Well, I don't think the Food Network is the driver of food content anymore.
Anymore.
Like, I don't think it's the main source.
It was for a long time until
social media came about, until technology moved things. I don't think that's the fault of Food Network, but it's not what the youth are watching, you know. It's funny how the network has become like the Guy Fieri network, you know. Yeah. It's like absolutely. It's like Rob Dedrick on MTV. It's like you look at the channel thing, it's like all ridiculousness. And then you look everywhere, it's all Guy Fieri shows.
So true.
But I think it's still there and it's still making an impact, obviously, with the way they're pushing all these new competition shows and stuff. But it's not the thing. People watch TikTok right now, you know?
Yeah, so they know what they want and they find it. That's the thing about this generation. They don't just turn it on. I always compare Food Network to MTV for my generation. It's like we would turn MTV on, we'd leave it on. And some people, got into music and some didn't. The kids that watched us coming up, Food Network early days, they'll say to me, you taught us how to cook.
Well, Food Network taught me.
Right.
Or actually was the thing that got me into cooking.
Yeah.
Because even though I'd been around food, I was at the really low point in my life and it was the Emerald. Remember Emerald's first show?
That's right, yes.
The one where he was in a kitchen?
Yes.
In a checker box kitchen?
Yes.
It was that show that I was like, wow, there's something, like I need to go into this world. Then I started like going down this rabbit hole. And
that's amazing though. Like if you weren't on a great path and you saw somebody in the boob tube, you know, you saw this guy Emeril and you're like, wait, I could do that.
Yeah.
That's an incredible influence. You know,
it was huge, yeah.
We talk about what it is today and it's like, well, maybe somebody sees it on their phone. I don't know.
Yeah.
Wait, I want to check the time because I don't want to run out of time.
We've got 3 minutes and 17 seconds.
Okay, wait, then oh, we...
I can go a little bit longer. Move my alarm to... as long as let's keep going to the end. Have a thing at 11:15.
We'll get you out.
I'll go to 11:10.
But there's so much I want to talk to you about. You have a new book coming out.
I do.
Can you talk about it?
I do. Yeah.
And I love the title. Tell us about the title?
It's been so long. But shout out to Clarkson Potter. I love y'all. We've been working on this book for a while. It went through a couple rewrites. Actually, the direction of the book was going to be one thing, and then the amazing commitment and work with our editor, Jen, and our team, we pivoted halfway through. Like, we were already, like, a year and a half into the book, and we were just like,
You're almost there.
Well, what happened was COVID and all these things.
Yes.
And like,
oh, yes.
The book just didn't read the same anymore as when we started it, you know.
Yep.
And for anyone that's listening or watching, like, books take a long time. It's like
thank you for saying that.
It's crazy because you have this idea and you have this like really salient message and something's pulsating, but then you also have to think about this thing is not going to come out for two, three, four years like an album, and so you have to think about like, is it still makes sense?
Is this still a relevant topic?
Thing back out there? So
you have to re-look at it.
We were halfway through and it was like, just doesn't really resonate anymore. It felt because, you know, we started it during COVID and I was like, these were the feelings I was having at that moment. But then reading it like a year and a half later, I was like,
this is
fucking stupid. And then
On the Line podcast is brought to you by Freitag Cocktails. I'm so excited about these. Freitag, that's me. Friday in German. Hello. Friday's a great day for a cocktail. We make them in a family-owned distillery in San Diego. Chef crafted cocktails, our own bitters, our own vermouth. We make Manhattan, Negroni, Margarita. What else could you ask for? Go to freitagcocktails.com, order them today, and they'll be delivered to your door. Cheers!
And so we pivoted, and so the book is taking like 3.5 years to come out, but it'll be out next year.
Great.
It's called The Choy of Cooking.
The Choy of Cooking. Yeah. It's the best title Thank ever. You. Come
and
on.
And it's turning into the dream of the book. I mean, it's a straight-up cookbook. It's my first like straight-up cookbook because the first book was a memoir. But the dream of the book is kind of, you know, because the name is so powerful, I want it to live, you know, for a long time.
Yes.
I want the recipe. So that's where things started to pivot. I was like, okay, we have to look at these recipes and this book in like an evergreen way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the imagery I had was, what if in 300 years from now, someone's at the Rose Bowl flea market and they're sifting through a box and they pick up this book, The Choy of Cooking. Like, will it still resonate to this person 300 years from now? So we started like thinking, like that became our North Star of like how to make this book.
And that's a legacy.
Yeah, and I wanted to make these recipes so that they could exist over time. They could
I don't
make
know what
a difference
it is
in
about
your life.
When you write a cookbook and you put it in print, it feels so permanent.
Yeah.
And it feels like I'm so scared of embarrassing myself by by putting something out there that isn't correct. Yeah. I don't, everything in my life, I'm like, yeah, whatever, you know, it's, you do your best and then you're judged or not. And it's okay. It's a fleeting moment, but there's something about the permanence of a
Well, the, you know, book. The thing is, I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but people really read the recipes.
They
that's,
do.
That's oh my God. Yes.
Because we as cooks don't really read the recipes.
Of course not.
Of y'all know. We don't really read. We
glance. Yeah, notes that are like, yo, I made your mushroom gravy and it was salty.
Exactly.
I'm like, wow, thank you.
I wanted to write a cookbook where it's like you put the ingredients and then you make that bracket and you write BTB, like bring to boil. Like I just always wanted to write like a chef's cookbook that way. But, you know, editors don't like that. And it doesn't work.
They really, like people who use our cookbooks, they really read them and they follow them to a T. So it is important to believe in that permanence, you know, because it does matter. Like, but because we're professionals, what happens for us is we just glance over it and then we register that and then we go cook, you know.
But
we don't look back at the recipe and say, oh, a cup like this.
A lot of pressure. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure. I just thought it's that same thing. You don't want to put anything out there that's permanent that doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, a biscuit recipe or a cake recipe that's never going to work.
There are people that can you know, make lots. That's been my problem for my whole life is that I, for whatever reason, I care. You know?
I love that you said that. Dan cares. We all care.
I don't know why. But why do you keep on opening restaurants? Like, why are we sitting here doing I don't know why I'm driven to give a shit. It would be so much easier if I could just put some garbage in. And I mean, that would be great.
No,
and just get
don't
paid
do
for
that.
It.
Don't do God. It. And I love what Roy said too. Like a book takes 2, 3, 4 years. I remember meeting this woman who had this gorgeous book. It was a Nordic cookbook. And I was saying, oh, I've been playing with wanting to do something. And she's like, well, it takes at least 2 years to make a good book.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's people that churn and burn, right, books. But you care.
You
care
about
what
you know. So really
ours is coming out next. It was 2024. It's coming out spring of 25.
So how many years is that between your first book?
We pitched it. Oh, between the first book, when it comes out, will be 12 years.
12 years.
I had a 10-year writer block.
To write another book. Yeah. And then 10 years writer block, which I think everybody understands. Mm-hmm. But also it'll take you 4 years for that book to have from inception to now.
You need at least 1 year. Because the normal pattern is, as you all know, is when you sign a contract for a book, you get 1 year to write it.
Yeah.
But sometimes it takes a little more than 1 year. But you get 1 year to write it. And then the publisher needs 1 year to put it together because they have to edit it. They have to do the art. They have to do the photography.
They have to grow the children to typeset and print it overseas where they can.
It does go overseas.
Get the profits.
But it really does take a lot of time. And like you said, 10 years.
But the other thing is not just the time of the real situation is like I wrote a cookbook, right? I spent however much time developing these recipes and this point of view concept. And then people are like, yo, that cookbook's great. Now write another cookbook.
Yes.
Like, okay, well, I don't have 100 recipes. Like, I can just copy some crap off the internet and put it out there. But if you really want me to put, it's like Malcolm Gladwell's first book is a spectacular book. His second book comes out 5 years later. It's like, now he's written like 9 books. I'm like, you think he's got that many great ideas? What is this guy? Like the most prolific genius on earth? Maybe. But, you know, the first book is more special than the last.
Right.
Like, sorry, buddy.
No, but I love that you guys said that because it makes me feel
Malcolm
a little better.
Malcolm Gladwell slipping.
Yo, just saying, the tipping point tipped.
I hope he's listening. but anyway, so before we let you go, let's talk about Tacos Por Vida. You're taking that to Stagecoach this weekend. Is that going to happen there?
Kogi will be at Stagecoach this
weekend.
Tacos Por Vida has taken a 3-week hiatus because we had to do Coachella and Stagecoach, which takes our whole team.
Sure.
You know, it's a whole Herculean effort to get out there and do our thing. And then, but we'll be back May 2nd, beginning of May. And then I think we'll be back for good. You know, it was a pop-up for the first, because again,
it worked.
It just happened. It happened on a whim. It worked. And we were working everything out in real time. We didn't want to make any promises, you know, but it worked. And so now we figured it out. And I think we're going to go open for real.
And for the locals and for the people who are listening, how does it work? Where will it be? Have you been?
So I've been
there,
there
on the first night. Yeah.
And you know, there's a shift that happened in LA, like the food truck thing. You developed that. It was, you know, really helped to make it a thing, spectacular, out of the restaurant onto the street. But you go to Mexico City and the tacos are on the street. They set it up right in front of you, and there's a real connection between the person. And I noticed that shift happen in L.A. A couple of years ago. You started to see these pop up where people are taking their truck, driving, unloading, unpacking, and putting the food
popping
on the
up grill. A 6-foot table,
big grill on the street, smoke coming up, you know, over charcoal. And it's like really special. You're really connecting directly with the person. They hand you your food. It's not like down from the truck. You're like,
so there's no truck. It's just
no truck. It's on the street, just like he's describing. Yeah. It's the concept, the idea of it was to do live fire backyard barbecue grilling over mesquite. Do like just strip it all the way down to the basic most. Core forms of food that we grew up around, carne asada, al pastor, pollo asado, and then doing handmade tortillas. So really it's handmade tortillas, the meats and marinades we grew up around, and then live fire. And just being out there.
Are you allowed to just do that? I mean, if I'm like, yo, I make these amazing like onion marinated grilled lamb kebabs, can I just go out on the street and sell them? How does that work?
You can, yeah. And then
if you don't get caught, you'll get busted. Yeah. Everything's legal in Jersey.
Roy says you can do it.
Everything's legal till you get caught, right? Shit.
I mean, is it the health of I just don't understand because it feels so like visceral
it's
and
so
free.
Rogue. And, I love it.
I don't have the answer to that. We're just doing it. We're just what we try to use is our own measurement as of cleanliness and you know, like honesty to you know, as a chef, you know, I'm a trained chef. So like, we just try to be clean, organized, have our mise en place, you know, everything on ice.
So far, I've never killed anybody.
Yeah, our hot food's hot and our cold food's cold. But we do have a license to operate, you know, and we're on private property. So that helps a little bit too. And everyone just loves our
And you're in the same
stuff.
Spot. Each
right
time.
Now, again, we're still a baby, so we don't know where it's going to go. Like, the thing about Kogi is we have a history of going all throughout this county, in Orange County, and we have so many different locations of loyal fans. So our dream is to start bringing it around to everybody.
But for now, tell everybody where it's going to be.
We're on Overland, 3434 Overland Avenue in West LA in the city of Palms.
Just down the block from my house, which is thank you.
Yeah.
He did it for you, Dan.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
It's for you.
But it's fun, man. It's fun cooking. I haven't opened anything new in LA in 7 years. So in 7 years, so much has changed in the food world. All the stuff we've been talking about on this podcast, you know, there was no content creators. There were no ASMR chefs. There was no TikTok. There was no nothing. So so much has changed. There's a whole new audience. And I just felt like it was time to maybe reintroduce the culture of Kogi in a new way, waiting outside. You know, like people think waiting sucks. It does, but there are certain.
Oh man, that's
the
community.
But there are certain things where waiting is fun, like where when you're waiting for a roller coaster, or where you're waiting for.
Have
food.
You been to those Texas, like Austin, Texas barbecue
Austin,
spots?
Texas barbecue.
Yes. They give out beer online, and it's like
that's what I'm saying.
It's
like,
part of the whole situation.
It's fun.
And by the way, I remember going to Kogi and thinking like, you spend $150 for a 3-hour meal at this fancy restaurant, or. You get a 3-hour meal at Kogi, it's 2.5 hours away in the line, but it's $10, and it's the same feeling when you're surrounded by like-minded people that are
all
excited.
But think about, like, let's say you want to catch up on podcasts, on this podcast.
Yes.
You want to get all that. You could wait in line and listen to all of them.
Yeah.
You could get stoned. Yeah. You could hang out. You could just be
in line.
You're
outside.
You're outside.
Chilling.
And so everyone really buys into that. And I didn't know if this new generation was going to, like, vibe with that, but they did.
I'm so happy to hear that.
That's why Tacos Pavrita took off. But it's also going back to like cooking like one thing again.
Yeah.
You know, and I know in the chef world and the European mindset, it's like you got to be fancy and proficient. You've been talking about it this whole podcast, fancy and proficient and everything. But we were joking about Japan. But like, I think as I get older and I grow as a cook, all I want to do is be good at like one thing the rest of my life. You know, like. Those cooks that cook those om rices, like that's all they do over and over again. But every single one is like
I've been talking about making pizza.
It's an art.
And every time I throw a pizza in the oven, it's like almost perfect. Yeah. It feels so special to do.
Right?
But there's always it's never perfect. It's like almost there.
Almost there.
And then every time you get a little bit better. And it can be just as fulfilling if you reset yourself. My Uncle Barry, you know my Uncle Barry.
Yeah.
My Uncle Barry spent his whole life, he was a carpenter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he was a cabinet maker, and he started a general contracting business so he could make money, and he built his, you know, his life in Manhattan, and he did well and he grew it. And then finally he retired and he built himself a little shop in his garage. Yeah. And he called me the other day and he was like, did I tell you this already?
No.
He called me the other day and he was like, you know, I spent my whole life trying to make money so that I could blah, 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 and get where I was to eventually be able to retire and do the thing that I started out wanting to do, which is just like one, just build stuff build in my stuff. Cabinet yeah. shop, in my garage. Like, and you can have that from the beginning.
Have it from the beginning.
If your dream, you know, we all want to have enough money to, like, it's the American dream to have enough money to live. But the American dream isn't to be like a billionaire. You don't need extra money. That's just getting in the way of your happiness.
It's lucky though. Sometimes we have to go through all those steps to get back to that place. Sure. But there's some people that are able to find it really early, like the sushi chefs and like the pasta, you know, grandmas in Italy or whatever. Like, they're just making this like one thing for like 70 years. Yes. And it never changes.
And they're
like,
fine with it.
And they're fine with it.
They're happy with it.
Yeah.
They make it with lots of love every day. And I'm really glad that the pendulum has swung back and that this generation 7 years later is embracing what you're doing. That you feel good about it, because sometimes I get a little jaded. I'm like, they don't understand, but I think they do. And I think there's a real community that's coming back. And thank you for continuing to do what you do, because if it wasn't for people like you, I think I personally would get a little lost in, you know, what it was that made it so special for us in the beginning and what the future is of food, you know? And I think we've come to find, after talking to many chefs like you, the future's bright. The future is bright.
A Return to Craft by Amanda Freitag.
But for real, because I get a little lost. And then when I go and see the students, I'm like, wow, they're really excited to go into this world. Maybe it's very different than what I was doing, you know? But just to know that you still care. There's care that's still going on, but that people are responding to that.
Yeah.
And they get you. So we got to go. We got to wrap it up.
Yeah, we got 2 minutes. You got anything else to say?
I want to give a quick shout out. Embarrassing enough, but there was a time when Roy turned down Oprah Winfrey on an interview. So I just want to say that, not that we're more famous. Yeah. You were famous for that. You were like, yeah, no, I don't have time for that.
fuck the Illuminati, man.
So just not that I'm Oprah, but you know. Just thank you for that. Maybe you know, next Oprah.
Right? Yeah, it's all coming out now, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, you see it.
Honestly, I mean, the best part about doing this is not only do I get to sit in a room with Dan, but I get to sit in a room with people like you and talk to you. It re-inspires me every time.
Congratulations on this podcast.
Thank you.
It was kind of random, but it made sense. Like, when I saw you guys together doing the thing. And
there's a connection.
I love your whole tagline, AF.
Thank you. Yes, know? I finally found out that I was cool.
Is there a book called? It should be called Easy AF. Is it called Easy AF?
I'm working on it.
All right.
That proposal was sitting on my desk since before COVID. And I keep looking at it. I'm doing the same thing you do. And I'm like, is this still relevant? Do people still want this?
Yeah.
Easy AF. Would be a huge.
It's got to happen.
Yeah, it's got
to
happen.
It's got to happen. So you just inspired me today to push it forward. So thank you for being here. I can't thank you enough. The Joy of Cooking. I can't wait for that to come out.
Yes.
And we're just going to follow you and keep loving what you're doing.
Thank you all.
And keep doing what you're doing.
I will follow you on Twitter.
Okay, please.
Just follow him around town.
And thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Woo! Season 2 of On the Line was recorded in Santa Monica, California at Operation Podcast. Thanks, Chase.
Our engineer and editor is Matthew Donahue. Our theme song is an original composition by John DeLucci. Thanks, Chef.
On the Line is produced by Cindy Augustine. Our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
Our social media and marketing guru is Kedzie Teller.
Thanks for listening
to On the Line.